Okay, we will call back to order the House Interim Revenue Committee and welcome Liz Beth, the only staff economist from whom we have not yet heard. It's just great for new members to get to meet our entire complement of outstanding staff today. And Elizabeth, you're going to give us the background on the Elderly Rental Assistance Program discussion, and then committee we have Elizabeth Archenko, Director of the Department of Revenue, coming at 1:45. So, Elizabeth, you're on.
Hey, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office, and I work in the property tax area and local government area. So what I'll begin to do is give you a little bit of background on our property tax relief programs here in Oregon. And I'm going to go through some of the highlights from this research report, 7-01, which is Oregon senior population growth and some property tax.
I'm sorry, yeah, just committee, we have the research report. We do not have the slides, so we'll have to watch the screen, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I didn't make copies of the overhead just because it is real similar to, you know, your report. And I haven't gone through and included all the graphs and things that are in this report. So once you have time to go through and read this report, you know, feel free to let me know if you have any questions or if you want additional detail on, like, population data of your senior or total population in this state. I have that kind of stuff downloaded now from the 2000 census. So basically, some of the objectives of this report was just to examine the 2000 census data trends in Oregon's senior population, and then to compare that with 1990 census data and look at some of the 10-year trends in the senior population and household data. Then to just summarize some of the property tax relief programs in other U.S. states, and to just kind of look at how Oregon's property tax relief programs size up with different states throughout the U.S. And then finally, to just analyze some of the major trends that we're seeing in Oregon's Elderly Rental Assistance Program and the Property Tax Deferral Program, and that's where Elizabeth Harshenko will come in and talk in more detail, too, about the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. And as just kind of a way of introduction, I know most of you know, but during the 1990s, you know, Oregon had the two major property tax relief measures, Measures 5 and 50, but these, and they really did lower property taxes and that burden for all homeowners. But we didn't have specific property tax relief just for low-income homeowners in Oregon. And that is really what the focus of this paper is try to look at some of these low-income homeowners. And the reason why is because we've talked about this through OTM, in 2000 when we had that study completed that really did find that, you know, the low-income homeowners are the ones that have the highest tax burden in Oregon of any other income group. And this is really due to the regressivity of the property tax system. And so, in prior to our current situation between 1973 and 91 in Oregon, we did have the HARP program, as I'm sure a lot of you remember. But really, with HARP, these did make property tax refund payments to all low-income homeowners. But that did end in the 91 session. And there were various proposals since then. I mean, we've seen since 91 of various types of property tax relief for seniors that have come through the legislature. So this is really just trying to look at some of the various alternatives that could be incorporated into other future legislation. And to look at, to consider some of the trends that we see in the 2000 census is that Oregon's percentage growth between 1990 and 2000, as far as the number of households that have one member that are over 65 years old, we are ranked 12th highest in the U.S. as far as just the percentage growth in that category. So that is pretty high compared to other states. I think Nevada was the highest at like 69%. And one of the tables in this report goes through and highlights the eight western states and what was their percentage change in households with senior population.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, that's 12th highest percentage change.
That's right.
Where do we rank in
population?
Actual percentage of our population over 65?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nolan, you mean like what percent of our population is over 65 compared to other states?
Yes.
I don't think I'd know that. Yeah, I haven't looked that up.
If we were 50th and moved up to 48th, that's one thing. If we were 10th and moved up to number 8, that is a very different.
Paul? Representative Nolan, I think we're right around actually that same area, 10th to 12th.
Okay.
I can check that out real quick. But we have traditionally had the highest percentage of our 65 population among the western states.
Mm-hmm.
But there are eastern states that have a higher percentage.
Representative Nolan, we currently have, with this 2000 population data, about 13% of our population that are over 65.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a statistic, but I don't know what it is.
How that ranks
yeah.
from the other 50, the other 49.
Okay, so currently what we have for these low-income homeowners in Oregon is that we have the property tax deferral program, and this does allow homeowners to defer their taxes and pay it off in future years or after they pass away. But there is no homestead program currently or any tax credit for low-income homeowners. Now, basically, with some of the trends that we see in the population data, just so everyone's clear, Oregon's total population grew 20% over the past 10 years to 3.42 million people. And that was 11th ranked in the U.S. in terms of the percentage change in population. Now, with Oregon seniors, what we've seen is that they also have grown between 1990 and 2000 at a rate of 5.3%. We're now at 438,177 seniors, as reported in the 2000 census. And basically, the annual growth rate, though, this is the thing that's really changing, is that this growth rate has significantly slowed between 1990 and 2000. And so now our annual growth rate is only about 0.5%. And it was even as high as 3.5% annually in 1982. So this has been declining slowly. And what we also, a trend that we see in our population is when you look at this graph, it kind of illustrates it pretty well in terms of this category right here is the seniors that are 65 to 69 versus the blue is those aged 70 to 74 and the final those aged 75 to 79 are in the red and the purple there is 80 to 84 and then the dark blue is 85 plus. So what you see, though, is in between 90 and 2000 of this younger group of seniors there, between 65 and 69, that actually dropped between 1990 and 2000. There was an 8% drop for those younger seniors. But what you see in the future is that between 2000 and 2007 here, these are the forecasts by JASC. Of the senior population data that is going to grow again. But what you saw between 1990 and 2000, the largest percentage increase was in this 85, the oldest seniors, and that grew by over 50%, with 51% growth in 10 years of the oldest seniors. And basically what we're going to see overall is that the 65-plus group of seniors are projected to grow by 7% over the next 7 years between 2000 and 2007. Now, to kind of look at another statistic that is getting at Representative Nolan's question, which is basically looking at what percent of the population in this particular, what percent of the population in a county are seniors, and looking at the differences between counties. And what you see is that rural and southern and southeast counties have the highest percentage of seniors as a portion of total population. And you can see that from this graph here. The ones here which are in red here show 20% or more. And that's like Wheeler and Curry and Tillamook. And so those counties had the highest percent of their population that were actually seniors. And then, as you see, like a dark blue here is Washington County. And as you can see, Washington County had the lowest. It had about 9% of their population are seniors. So you've got a big range there between counties as far as their percent of their population that are seniors. Now, what other trends we see in the senior population data is that on average, we see about 78% of all senior households are homeowners, and about 22% are renters. Now, this is a pretty consistent statistic, and this is those numbers haven't changed much over the last 10 years if you look at the 1990 census data. And this is really helpful to be able to break down our household into homeowners and renters when we're trying to analyze then, you know, what effect our different policies are having on homeowners versus renters. And that's going to be figure five in your report on page 7 breaks down then homeowners by regions. And it divides up the state into 8 different regions. And then it gives the statistics of what are the total number of homeowners and renters by regions. And the trend that you find is that, as we can probably guess, it's the central region where you have Deschutes County and Jefferson County. Those had the highest percentage change in senior homeowners and renters. They had more than a 30% increase over the last 10 years in their senior population. And they also had that, the central region was also the largest number of total population growth, too, as well as seniors. But what you saw as the lowest for the senior population growth rate was the metro area. Okay? And the Portland metro area, meaning Multnomah, Washington counties, Clackamas, Yamhill, they had the smallest percent change in the number of senior homeowners and renters. And again, that's figure 5 in your book, which is in your report that breaks that down for you. But what you see, the major trend then is and there's another table in there, table 2, which basically breaks down by cities. It takes the top 25 cities in the state, and it ranks them according to total households. And on that table, it basically shows that Portland has obviously got the largest number of total households. But if you look at who had the highest percentage change again between 1990 and 2000, you see the city of Bend had the highest growth rate of senior homeowners of 145%, and the city of West Lynn had the highest percentage growth rate of senior renters of 132%. But what is kind of interesting and what kind of brings home is that the city of Portland then, you know, which kind of explains why the metro area had such low percentage changes in their homeowners and renters, is the city of Portland had a decline in both their number of senior homeowners and renters over the past 10 years. And it was about, for homeowners, about 5%, and for renters, about 10%. So another kind of...
Mr. Chairman,
mm-hmm.
Do we have any concept whether that would have to do with life expectancies in an urban environment or migration or... in and out migration, or what would cause that? Do you have any clue?
Representative Hayden, no, I haven't really, you know, dissected why exactly,
right.
Portland. I would think one reason might be just because of the home prices, you know, for senior homeowners. I would think people would want to maybe move out of that region if the homes were getting quite expensive, which we have seen.
Although it's interesting in homeowners, Bend, where you probably got some of the highest valued property, I would expect. That's clearly an income group issue there. Folks.
True, but that would be a smaller population.
That's true. We're talking percentages, yeah.
Interesting.
And also what you're seeing, which is, you know, something that makes, you know, quite a bit of sense logically, is that as seniors do grow older, then you're seeing a larger portion of them sell their homes, and then they become renters. And again, this is a pretty consistent trend over the past 10 years. The 1990 statistics are not much different. This is table 3 in your report. But basically, we see that about the age group between 65 and 74, they are probably 80, according to the 2000 census data, 83% of those senior homeowners or households are owners, versus 17%, which are renters.
Was it?
Mm-hmm.
What's the definition for this purpose of a renter? Is a senior in an assisted living facility or in a even a care home considered a renter for these statistics?
Chairman Cheverly, that's correct. Yeah, they would be considered a renter, as well as somebody just living in an apartment.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So. Okay. They're still counted if they're in...
Yeah, if they're in those homes. Mm-hmm. And the seniors that are like 75 plus, they're that percentage of homeowners drops to 74% from 83%. So you are seeing a drop as seniors get older. Now I'm going to move on, and if there aren't any other questions about population data, I'm going to move now to just kind of trying to gather and look a little broader sometimes in what we do, just looking at specific bills during legislative session, just to kind of look at various programs that there are out there for property tax relief. And so what I've done is look at a report by AARPE, and it's called the State Economic, Demographic, and Fiscal Handbook for 2000. And in that handbook, the author has gone through and surveyed 51 different states and their various revenue staffs, and gone through and analyzed what are the property tax relief programs. And I've just summarized that for you and just kind of presented some of the statistics. So to begin with, I've categorized these into three different categories. First of all, you have homestead programs, and you have circuit breaker programs, and then you have tax deferral programs. And the first one being homestead programs. Now, what these are is traditionally these are reductions, okay, in assessed value for a home that is subject to property taxes. So this is homestead programs are for homeowners, not for renters, okay? And so basically with homestead programs, this is probably the most common form that is used by U.S. states to give property tax relief. And we see 45 states, or basically 88% of all states, have some kind of a homestead exemption program. And we see about 11 states which have like a limited exemption program, which means basically that they're targeted at certain homeowners. Could be war veterans, could be disabled population. And many of these will have could have an income requirement that's attached to the homestead exemption. Now, Oregon is in this category because Oregon provides a partial property tax relief program to disabled war veterans and the surviving spouses of the war veterans. And so with that program, it's state mandated, and we do give a reduction in the assessed value for the homes of war veterans. They do have to meet an income requirement of, I think it's about $8,000 if they don't have a spouse or anything. But it is a loss in local revenue. Okay, so this is different than a lot of the circuit breaker programs, which are state financed. Okay, this is something that with Oregon's war veterans exemption, it is something that local governments absorb the cost of that program. But what you see with a lot of states with homestead programs is that most all states have, you know, the states that don't have, there's only six states here that don't have a homestead program. And those six states, they do, all of them have a circuit breaker program, okay? And some of them even have a circuit breaker and a tax deferral program. So the point is that if they aren't providing some property tax relief through a homestead program, then states are providing that property or the property tax relief for homeowners in a circuit breaker program. Now, with circuit breaker programs, these are basically state finance tax credits, can be for either renters or for homeowners or for both. When we had the HARP program, that would be considered a circuit breaker program. It was given to both renters and to homeowners. Basically, what we're seeing in 2000 is that there's 71% or 36 states that have a circuit breaker program. And then you have 27 states out of those 36 which provide assistance to both renters and homeowners. Okay, there's 8 states with a tax credit program that just help homeowners exclusively. Okay, but Oregon is the only one that provides help to assist just senior renters exclusively. And that's what we have in the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. And there's a list of all these programs in the various states on table four. So if you are interested in how different states structure it, the maximum benefit, maximum income and things, you can look that over. With the Elderly Rental Assistance Program, the income limit on that is $10,000. And it's not indexed to inflation or anything, but there's only, if you kind of compare the income limits of other states, you see only three states out of the 36 that have a program that had an income level that was below 10,000. It was below Oregon. Okay, now to just discuss a little bit about property tax deferral programs. You basically see about 47% of the states, or 24 states, that actually had a deferral program in 2000. Oregon's tax deferral program is the oldest in the United States. It was one of the first ones, and it's one of the largest on a percent of their population that is actually participating in the program. Most deferral programs are restricted to seniors or disabled. There's three states, Florida, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C., that allow all state homeowners to participate in the deferral program. But most all of them are a common trend is to see an income requirement for most deferral programs. They sometimes restrict it even on the basis of property taxes as a percent of income. It can sometimes be a restriction on being able to participate in the deferral program. Sometimes it's, a certain percent above, like, say, 3% of income. If your property taxes are above 3% of income, then you'd be able to defer that amount. So, there's a whole variety of things. A lot of states give full property tax deferral, like Oregon does. But some of them just give a partial deferral, too. I think another trend that you see within homestead programs is that all the states have established some kind of a maximum benefit, and then there's about 18 states that actually had an income or an asset test applied with the homestead program. And with circuit breaker programs, usually all of them had income requirements and a maximum benefit. And that's just a way in which, states have been able to limit the cost of those programs. And again, with Oregon, we have a limited homestead exemption for the disabled, war veterans, and spouses. And then our circuit breaker program is just for low-income senior renters. And our tax deferral program is for the low-income senior and disabled. But what you really find as far as a conclusion of all of this is that other U.S. states have, some type of tax credit or a tax exemption program for senior homeowners rather than a limited homestead exemption and a tax deferral program like Oregon has.
Question?
Yes.
You were talking about the income and asset test in these three areas in Oregon, and it may be here, but we're going through it rather fast, but I understand, I see the income test. Is there an asset test on all three of these in Oregon?
Representative Walker, there is an asset test on the ER, the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. It has to be less than $25,000.
That's the only one that has an asset test?
That's right.
Thank you.
Any other questions about the other states or anything like that?
Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Okay. To go through some of the trends now in the various programs that we have here in Oregon, just to kind of give you a little bit of a pretense of the programs. Basically, with the property tax deferral program, we did see in the beginning between 1973 to 74, all the way until 1989 to 90, we did see a rise in the property tax deferral program. I think in 1989-90, that was the year in which we had the most people participating in the property tax deferral program, and that was 13,165 people. But now, since that time, during the 1990s, we've seen a decline, okay, in the number of seniors that are participating in the property tax deferral program. We've seen a decline of 4,154 people. So, this is something that, the reasons for the decline really are probably linked to some market factors, in particular the size of people's property taxes, And then also the level of the market interest rate. And right now, the property tax deferral program interest rate is 6%. It's simple interest, but to look at that is pretty important because, you know, people can look at other options as interest rates fall below 6% as ways in which they could pay for their property taxes. So this may be something that's causing some people to move out of the program. And the thing with the property tax deferral program is once you qualify, it's not like you have to defer your taxes every year. You can choose what years you want to defer your taxes. You can come in and out of the program.
Without triggering liability for the deferred
for repayment. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. What another important trend that you've seen is as you've been seeing the number of people actually participating in the program declining, since 92, 93, the senior repayment has exceeded the total taxes paid. Okay, that's been happening since 92, 93. And the Department of Revenue has given money back to the general fund. In July of 2001, they gave back $17 million, and there's been a couple other payments in prior bienniums. And what we're seeing is that this net revenue paid between the senior repayments and the taxes that need to be paid out to counties for property taxes that are deferred, that net revenue has increased like 448% between 1992 to 2001. So that's quite a large increase through the 1990s. Now, Table 6 in your book is one that goes through and gives you the statistics on the amount of participants, the total amount of taxes paid versus repayments, and then the difference between the two. In 2000, what we've seen, and I just kind of wanted to make this one of the things that links some of the census data then with our program participants. So I went through and gave a list there of program participants by county and went through and then looked at what was the participation rate for homeowners in the property tax deferral program. And you see statewide that but only 4% basically of the senior homeowners are deferring their property taxes. Now, this is not low-income senior homeowners. This is all senior homeowners. And this is just trying to give you an idea of how many seniors are out there in 2000 versus how many are actually affected by the property tax deferral program or the property tax relief program. We basically see that most of the people participating in the deferral program, about 26% of all those deferral program candidates are in Multnomah County. And then if you add in the metro area, Clackamas and Washington counties, in addition to Multnomah County, you have about 42% of all senior deferral participants are in those three counties. Now, the changes that we saw during 2000 one legislative session was we had House Bill 2208, and basically what this did was deal with the initial household income limit to qualify for the program. And just to make it clear to everyone, the deferral program has basically two limits in order to qualify for the program and continue to participate in the deferral program. First of all, there's a household income limit to qualify initially, and then to remain eligible for the program benefits, there's a federally adjusted income limit. And so what happened with House Bill 2208 last session is that we raised the initial household income limit to the same as the federally adjusted gross income limit, so that the two are now the same in the sense they're both $32,000, but one is based on your household income versus one is based on your federally adjusted gross income. The federally adjusted gross income is a broader test. It's one that is easier to meet than to first initially come on the program with a household income limit of being $32,000. Now, what we also are doing is indexing then this initial household limit to come on the program as well as the federally adjusted gross income to go off the program in order to remain qualified for the program. So now they're both set at $32,000 and they're indexed each year. In addition to that, we also raised the income limits for the deferral of the special assessments. The special assessments are a small portion of the deferral program. The property tax deferral is, special assessments are only a couple hundred a year. Now, basically with some of the projections that the Department of Revenue has made on the tax deferral program is that in 2001-02, there are roughly 9,176 participants, and 2001-02 is the first year that the disabled population can come on the program. And that happened in the 99 session to allow the disabled population to come on. But we now see that in 2001-02, in the first year, there's just 190 disabled that'll come on in the deferral program. As far as what is the balance in the revolving fund account for that account, there's $34 million in there. And like I said, they've already given some $17 million before that in July of 2001. And the net revenues are, and when I'm saying net revenues, I'm talking about the amount of revenues that seniors will repay minus the amount that Department of Revenue has to pay to the counties for what they're projecting are the amount of participants in the program. So those net revenues are expected to grow by $8.6 million in 2001-03 and $4.9 million in 2003-05. And when you consider an administrative cost, then what the Department of Revenue projects is that in 2001-03 biennium, there'll be a $10.4 million net revenue increase and $7.4 million in the 2003-05 biennium. Okay, just talk now to about a little bit about the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. Again,
Elizabeth, before you do, let me ask.
Sure.
Director Hutchinko, how are you fixed for time here? How many slides do you have left?
Just a couple.
Okay. Okay. Are you okay with that? And then we can get the overview with this and then bring you on up. Okay. I know I'd asked you to come over early, so I apologize for having you wait now that I asked you. Okay. Thanks.
So with the Elderly Rental Assistance Program, basically, what we're seeing were the trends in that program. Again, it was enacted in 75. It was kind of an alternative to the HARP program. And basically, seniors have to be 58 years old. They have to live in a housing complex that doesn't already have a property tax exemption. They have to meet that household income limit of $10,000. And the refund payment is a function of the amount of rent and expenses they have for utilities, minus 20% of their household income. So basically with the ERA program, between 1980 and 89, we saw that the participants declined from 4,699 to 1,045. And the reason for this was that the HARP program was more attractive. It had a higher income level. And that we saw that once HARP started to be phased out, in an 89 session, then in 90 we saw that the ERA returns increased significantly to 11,372 returns. And at that time you saw people switching from the HARP program, senior renters switching from the HARP program to the ERA program. And so then what you saw though between the 1990s throughout the 90s we've seen a decline in the number of people participating in the program. And in the 91 session, ERA was expanded. So there were some changes that were made then in order to try to help the program meet target a larger group of seniors. But even with those changes, you still had a pretty low income threshold of only $10,000, and it wasn't indexed at all to inflation. And another reason for the decline could be that there was, more homes and housing complexes for renters that were getting property tax exemptions. And that once you have more homes that are getting property tax exemptions, they're supposed to be giving and transferring lower rents to the renters, and so they cannot qualify for an ERA return. Now, what you see in 2000 is that there was when you look at the participation rate of senior renters, you do see a significantly larger number of overall renters are using this program versus the property tax deferral program, where you've got 12% of all renters are using the ERA program. And one of the things that you're seeing in the future is that there's was a large mailing in 2001 due to some of the changes that are going to take place in the program. And in 2001, that number of ERA refunds really increased. It increased 838 refunds, where in the past, over the past throughout the 1990s, ERA has been seen as a slight decline each year. And so that's kind of one of the big differences. In 2001, we were making some changes with the program administratively, and so there was, you know, this outreach to try to inform seniors, and it did the job of increasing the participation, but it did it at a time when, you know, it's a tight budget now for this program. Oops. So one thing that we haven't really addressed yet is the nonprofit homes for the elderly. And this program is tied in the appropriation with the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. So basically with this program, it is designed to provide private nonprofit corporations who are providing elderly residents with various facilities, you know, housing and recreation and things. All of those facilities then qualify for a property tax exemption. And this is a state-funded property tax exemption. DR, Department of Revenue pays the counties for that loss in local revenue each year.
And do the rents have to be below market?
Yes.
As well? Yeah.
Yeah, and they're supposed to be reflecting the mm-hmm. property tax savings. Yeah. So during the 1990s, what you've seen where the ERA program was slightly declining each year with the nonprofit homes, you did see an increase in the number of homes that were qualifying for this property tax exemption. It went from like 18 homes in an 8-year period of time, went from 18 homes to 39 homes, which was an increase of like 217%. So you've seen quite a large steady increase each year of these homes. The average payment per home is about $26,000. And right now we have in 2001-02, 39 different homes that are qualifying for that program. Now, the changes that were made last session were in Senate Bill 425A and House Bill 2208. And basically, some of the administrative changes that went on were that prior to 2001-02, Department of Revenue had like a continuous filing, and they would continually accept senior claims for the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. But now we have established a specific filing deadline for the Elderly Rental Assistance Claims. And also the payment date has been moved to not later than November 15th, where prior to that it was in October. And this is just a way in which it allows the Department of Revenue additional time to make their forecast and to get all the claims prepared. And another change that was made was the nonprofit homes must file an application with the counties by April 1st. And also one of the big changes was now that the appropriation for the biennium must be split out between each year. And prior to 2001, any proration that might have been needed for this program occurred in the second year. And in the past, Department of Revenue has never had to prorate any of these program payments. And in the past, ERA program payments were the ones that would have been prorated. But now what we have from the changes last session is that both Elderly Rental Assistance Program payments and the county payments for the property tax exemption can be prorated if the appropriation is below the amount that is needed for program payments. So what we see right now, and this is what Elizabeth Hartchenko will talk about, is some of the potential proration of Elderly Rental Assistance and county payments in 2001-03. So basically, with the 2001-03 appropriation, it was $9 million. This is $2 million less than the 1999-2000 appropriation. The Department of Revenue projects a shortfall in revenue to pay all those program payments beginning in 2001-02, and so this just is a breakdown. Elderly rental assistance, about $4.5 million is the amount that would be needed in 2001, and nonprofit homes, about $1.1 million. Total being about 5.58 million, but what we see is that the budget, you know, is only 9 million, maybe, and how you're going to split up this budget between years is going to determine how much proration you need. In this particular case, I just split up this budget according to the amount of projected program payments needed for both both years. And in that case, it's like a 48%, and the 48 of that $9 million is allocated in 2001-02 versus 52% in 2002-03. In this particular case, what you're seeing is a shortfall of about 22% of the program payments. This corresponds to about $126 per ERA claim and about $6,000 for a nonprofit home claim.
Is that it?
That's it.
All right, very good. That's, I think, a good lead into your presentation. Welcome, Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of the Department of Revenue and a favorite and regular before the committee. So welcome to our first interim meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Elizabeth Harchenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. Kim is handing you a sheet that contains pretty much what Lizbeth showed you on that last slide, sliced and diced a couple of different ways. I just wanted to report to you what it is we're doing. We were short funded. We had the conversation with the revenue committees. We also had the conversation with our Ways and Means subcommittee. And we asked you for some administrative tools to give us the ability to manage that resource so that we paid out what you gave us, but not more. And so what we have decided to do based on the changes in the statute is to try to prorate so that there aren't wild fluctuations between the 2 years and the biennium. As Lizbeth said, the shortfall looks like it's about a 22% shortfall across both programs, which are funded together. There's just a single, in our budget, there's a single $9 million line item appropriation to cover both of these programs, even though they're administered very differently. So what we're going to do is prorate at that 22% across both years. So we'll actually be paying out about $4.3 million this fall, and we expect to have to pay out about $4.7 next fall in order to maintain that roughly 78% payment level. I'll be reporting to the e-board at the November meeting, but I think that the payments will have gone out by then for this year.
Mm-hmm.
So
let me ask, with the filing deadline that we put in place, that is a date by which the claims have to be filed, you're going to be able to apply this proration evenly, that is on a pro rata basis, to all the claims when they're paid out, so that you're not going to have differences in proration based on when the claims came in?
That's correct.
Mr.
Chair, yes. We got the word out as best we could, and we had some support from the Department of Human Services to sort of get information out to those who are eligible for the program that there was a July 1 filing deadline and that any applications that came in after July 1st would be held until next year. So we knew very shortly after July 1st how many claims we had. We did go through and make sure that everyone was eligible and that they'd calculated the amount of their claim correctly and so forth. But we know how much, in terms of the Elderly Rental Assistance Program, how many dollars were claimed, and that's the basis for our projection for the division of that appropriation between the 2 years. The information on the nonprofit homes won't be really finalized until after the tax collectors calculate and extend taxes against the exempt values for those properties. And so we'll be getting the actual concrete information in from the counties towards the end of this month, as the assessors have already turned over the valuation part of the tax roll to the tax collectors. The tax collectors are now applying the tax rates, and they will report to us the actual taxes that would be due from the qualifying nonprofit homes for the elderly for this tax year, 2001, 2002. And then we will be sending out the checks, and they will be prorated across all of the qualifying homes as well.
Well, it sounds like what we had in mind when we did it. As I recall, when you left this committee, you were going to go down and see if you could still get a couple more $1 million out of Ways and Means.
Well, as I said, we raised the issue as part of our budget presentation. As you know, the budget was very, very tight being put together. So that it did go up and I think went on the board with many other options that if funding was available were to be considered, and the other priorities took up what was left. This is as Lizbeth pointed out, a very, very low income population that's eligible for these payments. So we're trying, as I said, what we're trying to do, at least within the biennium, because we know how many dollars we have for the biennium, is not have wild swings for folks over this two-year period.
And to treat them equitably across the population, too.
That's correct.
Okay, very good.
Questions?
Comments?
Yeah.
Representative Hayden?
The prorating, you used two terms that I wasn't quite clear on. One was prorating and one was 78%.
Okay. What we did was we looked at the volume of claims and how many dollars, if we had enough money to pay every claim, every appropriate claim, how many dollars would that take? Look then at what the appropriation is. Appropriation isn't sufficient to pay all the claims 100%, so we're paying basically 78 cents on the dollar for every dollar of eligible claim. That's what the 78% is, and we're doing that, as the chair described it, equitably across all claimants who will receive a payment this calendar, this fiscal year.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
And what agency is administering this program?
The Department of Revenue.
Department of Revenue. By happenstance, 78% is a figure that Department of Human Resources is using to control their health programs. Is there any relationship between those two figures?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, no, that's a coincidence.
Okay. Thank you.
And I take it if claims come in under what you, well, no, you've got the claims, so you know what they're coming in. So it's next year, if claims are lower, then it'll be a higher percentage. I mean, you'll be able to pay more if you get fewer claims. But
that's correct, Mr. Chair. If the dollar amount of claims eligible to be paid is less than we project based on the information we have now, and we'll be able to pay more per dollar.
Spread next year's dollars on next year's claims.
Across all the people who will be eligible for a payment in the fall of 2002.
Okay. I appreciate that. That's just what we had in mind. I think we knew we were designing this as a fallback to full funding. Mm-hmm. And short of that, I think this is the fairest way to go about it. And administratively, I assume this is a lot easier for you.
Well, it's certainly the way it was before you changed the law was very challenging because we didn't have the authority to reduce the payments on the nonprofit homes for the elderly. And the payment times were separated, and we had to pay the ERA payments before we knew how many dollars we needed for the nonprofit homes for the elderly. You've put those things together now, so the timing is the same, and we're able to know how many dollars need to go out the door before we've written any checks and to make sure we can stay within the appropriation.
Okay. Representative Hayden?
Director, are these single-family residence homes or are these group homes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, my understanding is it is any person who pays rent for their shelter. So it could be an apartment, but it would not be a single-family.
Are you talking about the ERA or the...
Oh, I'm sorry. The Elderly Rental Assistance is paid to individuals who pay rent for their shelter. The nonprofit homes for the elderly have to be not-for-profit. They have to meet certain other criteria specified in the statute, and they must apply to the assessor for verification that they do, in fact, qualify.
And those generally are group homes, aren't they? They're just...
Well, they would be It would be a setting where many people can
live. That's what I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Those folks would have to pay for the housing within the home. It's not single family.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming down. Coming over. Jacqueline, did you want to...
Mr. Chair, I was just
going to
say, they had addressed the administrative part of it, whether or not
the
costs have gone down
because of the machinery. Why don't you come on up and let's, if that's a question. Okay, we're a small crowd. If you could just restate what that question was for the record.
Well, as I understood the question, it was about our administrative costs for the program. And I don't believe that they've changed. That's something that's, so I don't have data on our administrative costs. If you'd like me to get that to your staff, I will do that.
Can you follow Liz back?
Okay. All right. Okay. We'll get our administrative costs to your staff.
All right. Thank you.
You need to have a breakfast.
Jacqueline Zimmer posed a question from the audience.
Yes.
What are you doing back here?
I know. Chairman, I just had one other question, and I thought I would relay it to you and make sure it's clear to everyone, too. It is in the report, but just understand that, you know, we now are prorating nonprofit homes for the elderly payments. Those are county payments that are going to the counties, but it's the counties, it's the local government, it's the school district that will be absorbing the loss in revenue.
Sure. Property tax.
So I think at the time that we were going through this, at least during session, it was a little unclear exactly, you know, whether it was the counties or whether it was the nonprofit homes that were actually going to be absorbing that proration. But it, according to Legislative Council, this is the way the bill was drafted, to just have those county payments be reduced.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Committee, that takes us then to the work plan as our wrap-up for the agenda today. Paul, do you want to introduce that for us?
I have to say, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. It's in your packet, if you've not seen it already. Go ahead.
I emailed this out, and one thing I neglected to put on it that is on your copy before you now is proposed work plan, so we can make some adjustments as based on feedback that we've gotten. The one the Chair mentioned in terms of meetings and locations. Just to go through some of the highlights with you, we do see this as an opportunity to look at some major issues and to spend a little bit more time than you have during the session where you've got things coming at you fast and furiously. So it's an opportunity to take a little different perspective. We do also have a whole series of updates and reports for you based on things that were done during the session. Some of them are things that were talked about by the committee and not formally in statute, but we've included those as well. And some of them are things from previous sessions that we've monitored. What I've done is try to break out some major issues there, and these are in discussion with the co-chairs. The first is on tax reform, which is an issue that the House committee during the session spent some time looking at, an issue, of course, that we have looked at a good deal in Oregon over the years, and the driving concern there is the heavy reliance on the personal income tax and the stability and economic growth implications of that. So that would be a continuation of some of the work that was done during the session. The other major issues there, the inheritance tax. This was an issue that came up right at the end of last session, which is part of the federal legislation, the federal tax reduction bill that passed in June. What that does is has a phase out for the pickup tax or the unified credit on the inheritance tax. And the way our system currently works is that we participate in a federal program, and any taxes that are paid up to a maximum amount off of an estate can be used as a dollar-for-dollar credit against your federal tax. So this is about as close as it comes to a no-brainer in terms of state tax policy. But that's changing. And one of the things I noticed here, starting in 2002, as the credit falls to 50%, credit falls to 25% in 02, and then 50% in 03, and then by 05, the credit is gone. So that means that from a policy standpoint, you have two choices. One is to not take any action, in which case Oregon law would connect you to the 1997 federal law. People wouldn't be able to use that as a credit against their federal taxes, but they would be paying the same amount of tax they are now on their estates. So in essence, we would have a standalone inheritance tax, not tied to the federal.
So the net death tax then to the decedent's estate would increase because you would be paying the same amount to the state, but you would not be getting the offset credit against the federal estate tax.
Well, the way that the amount of revenue would be the same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the tax burden on an individual would still go down, but it would only go down by the amount of the federal.
Yeah, I guess that's right. Sure.
So they're still getting a reduction, but they're not getting the full reduction. The other option is to look at basically what you're looking at then is a standalone inheritance mm-hmm. tax program, similar to what we had. The pickup tax had a long history going back to the 77 legislature that had a six-year phase-in to the federal pickup tax. So we do have a history of having a state inheritance tax. So that would be one thing to look at. And then to look and see what other states are doing in response. Most states that I've talked to have interpreted this change to an automatic change in their system. In other words, they have to take action to continue inheritance tax that they will phase out with the federal law. But the opinion we got from council is that you would have to take action for that to take place. So that presents you with a whole different dynamic in terms of the policy of inheritance tax. And at the end of the session, both revenue chairs and ways and means chairs felt this was an important enough issue to spend some time on. Preparing for the 03 session. Other issue is on bonding capacity, which is another major issue that we have included because it is something that's been looked at a lot in recent biennium, particularly lottery bonding. We've used it in terms of school finance. We did have a major proposal from the treasurer during the session to expand the state's role in financing school capital spending through a new bonding program. And we also had some major legislation that did pass, a seismic program that will go before the voters, SGR 21 and 22, and also a bonding program for LHSU, which will go before the voters. So the idea here is to look at our bonding capacity, to look at the issues around that, what our capacity is, what kind of a debt payment should we be looking at in terms of prudent fiscal policy over time? What are some innovative options that might be there in terms of financing some of the infrastructure in the state? We will also look at things like, for example, now we know the issue of the lottery has come up and how DAS is managing that, and that's something we've been in contact with them with issuing bonds, where there's some question as to the use of lottery to pay back those bonds. The fourth kind of big picture issue I have there is taxes and regional economic development. We talked about this in terms of long-term factors shaping revenue policy, and I think there's widespread thinking that revenue policy is a potential tool to shift growth into areas that have not benefited from economic growth, and it may also be that given discussion of the outlook that Tom went through with you today, that economic development issues may begin to emerge as a major policy issue, perhaps to a greater extent than they have over the last decade. I would point out that not only is the national economy slowed and Oregon slowed too, but Oregon now in terms of job growth over the last year is 48th. Job growth and has the second highest unemployment rate in the country. So we clearly have dropped down from where we were about 5 or 6 years ago. So I suspect we'll see a number of proposals in that area. And the intent here is to kind of inventory what we've done in terms of enterprise zone legislation, the SIP program that passed several years ago, strategic investment program, and to look at some various credits like Senate Bill 229 that have passed in recent sessions, and then take a look at what people in the field and experts are saying in terms of what's most effective in influencing investment and economic growth. The next one there on the top of the page, taxes and interstate commerce. This one was at the suggestion of Director Harchenko, who has spent a lot of time with the Multnomah State Tax Commission and looking at the issue of interstate commerce and how tax systems are responding to an increasingly integrated world and national system. Of course, the sales tax states are the ones that are very concerned about the impact of changing distribution and particularly the use of e-commerce as a means of purchasing things. There was a study done on the amount of e-commerce and its impact on sales tax collections, and it runs nationally about 2 to 2.5%, which is a pretty significant chunk. The other thing that's going on, there is federal legislation now that would look at taxation of interstate commerce, and is also looking at this business nexus issue, which is what does a business have to do to have nexus in the state for the state to tax it? And there we're not only talking about sales tax, but we're talking about corporate income tax, which was an issue that came up in terms of the apportionment formula decision. We do have some federal law that determines what is taxable, both in terms of sales taxes and in terms of corporate income taxes. But there's a real movement afoot to look at those in light of a changing economy. And as I say, some potential federal legislation. One thing states are doing is passing so-called model sales tax laws that are moving toward more of an interstate regional look at sales tax collections. So that would be, all of those things are tied together. And finally, the last item I have there is on initiatives. And initiatives, we never know what's going to come forth and get on the ballot. But we do know some things now that are in the works that I think have major revenue implications. One is a proposal to privatize OLCC, which would change our current monopoly system. We've seen proposals on reductions in capital gains. We did see a major legislation that was vetoed by the governor, Senate Bill 67. So to go back to look at some proposals in that area. There's a proposal to allow payroll taxes to be deductible on personal income taxes. And there may also be some consumption tax initiatives, both in terms of excise type specific taxes and broad-based consumption tax. So those,
not from me. I'm too busy to gather signatures.
So we'll have to see what arises. And we've kind of, as we look ahead for planning in terms of the meetings. Usually we would take this up in a September meeting of next year where we would know mm-hmm. what's on the ballot mm-hmm. and we'd start to get a sense for what the issues are going to be. The next group of items I have there are the updates and reports. And, of course, we've heard some of those already today. But we'll be going through those, particularly the revenue forecast. Our next meeting is November 30th, and that will be the initial release of that forecast. It will be before the committee. So you have an opportunity to find out that information when it first comes out. And then things like the Elderly Rental Assistance Program, we've had an update on that, but we'll be following those things through. One other thing I might point to also, right in the middle there, is school property tax collections. Department of Administrative Services is reinstating their school local revenue forecast group, and they will have produced an estimate by December 1, an update on what's happening to school and local property taxes. So you'll be getting that at the same time you get the revenue forecast in the general fund.
Again, do you think that'll be ready then by November 30 when you say by December? Okay, good.
Yes. so we'll have it on that day. Then there's the way the executive order works is that comes out twice, or comes out once a year. So it would be December 1, then December 1 next year would be the number that's used for the governor's budget. And then typically we'll make some adjustments on that during the session for your final legislatively approved budget. But of course, to keep in mind on those local property tax collections that we have over $2 billion in the formula from property taxes for schools. So a 1% change there, such as we saw last biennium, 1% shortfall, is $20 million. So that's a very significant amount of money. We don't know how the system, many parts of the system, respond to a recession, but the Measure 50 part of it, and we certainly know there's going to be more stability on the residential property side, because even if values fall, people are still going to be getting that 3% increment because they're still going to be way below market value. However, a lot of industrial property is at market value. Mm-hmm. So if we see some declines there, that will translate right away into revenue losses for local governments and for schools. So that's what we've really got to really keep an eye on, to see what happens to that revenue. And we don't expect to see the percentage swings we do on the personal income tax, but still, it's going to be sensitive to economic condition. The last piece I've included there on process, I think we've had some discussion of this already, six meetings would be two, then four during the calendar year 2002, dates to be determined. And those pretty much can take place where you'd like to have them, in discussion with the chairs. We had planned to either have them in Salem or basically at another location, if that's to be determined. But however you want to go in that direction.
I would suggest that for the purpose of adoption of these today, not knowing exactly where we will go with this, that we strike that second sentence, but coming back to Representative Hayden's comments before, that would be not a final decision to have all the meetings here in Salem, but rather one that we would just defer to seeing how the session plays out. I am not suggesting we foreclose that, but let's not. I'm suggesting that we not make it a part of the formal plan itself. And also, I would, I guess, move for our purposes that in each place in that last paragraph where it refers to subcommittees, that we add reference to work groups as well. Because frankly, I think that's more efficient with everyone's time to work with work groups as opposed to subcommittees. That's all I would say about that. I think the only change I would propose would be those changes, to strike that second sentence under process and then add reference to work groups in that last sentence, the last paragraph, in every place that subcommittees appears. Is there any objection to those changes?
Not an objection, but if I could modify that, we're close enough to Portland that I would agree with you that there probably wouldn't be the necessity of doing one in Portland, but I think one in Southern Oregon. I think one off-campus one would be very appropriate.
And again, I'm willing to entertain that and probably do it if we feel justified and comfortable in that in light of revenues and if people will come. I'm just suggesting we take it out of the formal plan. I don't know that it needs to be in the plan, but Representative Hayden, I have to keep that front and center as a concern. When you say how far off campus are you thinking when you talk about that? Down to Murphy or Anita or?
When we were talking about it. We were talking about Grants Pass.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Grants Pass is a little over 200 miles from here. Mm-hmm. And if we were going to have, and looking at this group that we have here, that would be a lot of mileage. And then having to take the committee staff as well to Southern Oregon, it's not an easy one day trip.
Driven
it three times.
We could talk. I mean, Roseburg is certainly a possibility. That's just about a 2.5-hour drive south, so that's not.
Well, Roseburg is only 69 miles from Grants Pass.
Yeah.
You know, and we have a very good facility for it there. I mean, I'm not saying we don't have a facility, mm-hmm. but we have an excellent facility in Grants Pass for it, which is 10 miles from where I live.
Oh.
That was a discussion that we had, and I just don't
Okay. Well, let's just reserve that.
Yeah. So we can reserve that and see how the budgeting is. I was just thinking that it's easier for one of me to drive from Grants Pass than it is for, you know, 10 of us in the owner area to drive down there.
And you'd have to guarantee a good turnout of locals down there, too.
That is true, yeah. And that's tough to do down there sometimes.
Well, we're going to talk about taxes. That'll bring them up.
You bet, but it may not be the ones you want.
Representative Nolan?
Not an objection, but a question for discussion while you're considering your work plan. Should I assume that the either subcommittees or work groups that you're anticipating would tie with the bullet that Mr. Warner identified?
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at a work group that would look at
tax reform,
yeah. Interstate commerce.
Yes, and a work group. And I'll tell you the two that I won't appoint today, but I'll solicit your expressions of interest on would be tax reform and inheritance tax. And in particular, we need to get an early run at so we have something ready to go. The rest, we bonding capacity, we're going to take that up at the next full committee meeting, and that may generate a work group if there is something that needs to be done from there. Taxes and regional economic development, I don't think we're quite there yet, but those first two, anyway, we can get started on after this meeting. And specifically, and inclined to add work group as opposed to subcommittee, I think it was just easier to deal with in a work group. Any other questions or discussion about the work plan? Then the chair would move that we adopt the proposed work plan with the changes noted in the last paragraph relating to process. Is there any further discussion on the work plan? Any objection? None. The work plan is adopted. And I will say, and I'm not asking for a show of hands, whether you'll let me know or maybe Paul know today, or if you'll call or email us. If you're interested in either one of those first two major issue work groups being tax reform and inheritance tax, let me know, and I'd like to get started on those. The interim is passing by. Okay. Well, with that, I think we're at the end of the agenda, aren't we? Have I overlooked anything?
If I might add, Mr. Chair, I think also, as you and I have discussed, is there are issues that come up that we have not anticipated, and this is not preclude us from doing any of those.
Absolutely. Well, and I think this especially said this session, as interim, as we're going to, if there are issues that come up as a consequence of the downturn in the economy, if there's anything for the Revenue Committee to do, why, we'll be ready to do it. I've gone with the experts. That's scary. Okay. Committee, I want to thank you. It's a good start. This is a good overview, I thought, of a lot of the issues that we've finished up with last session. I hope that was helpful to our newer members and kind of a fun little walk down memory lane for those of us who were on the committee in the session. We will see you then on November 30 as a full committee. And again, please be in touch with either of the co-chairs or with Paul if you are interested in either one of those first two work groups. And with that, we are adjourned.